Good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, as I always like to say when we start these podcasts. I am Eric Rubenstein. I'm the Senior Director of Litigation, Fraud, Waste, and Abuse Support here at Advise Health. Welcome to another great episode of the OIG Roundtable. Today, the table is round. It is not a triangle or a square because all four of us are here together. And I'm joined this week by the full cadre of our former OIG staff, for the most part. I think we've got a few that may not be able to make it. But as always, it's going to be a great half hour or so we're going to spend. And welcoming back my partners in crime, Matt Kachansky, former UPIC Northeast director, former senior leader at HHS OIG, 35 years of experience in fraud, waste, and abuse. Jason Eisengrein, former Western UPIC director, the Western UPIC, 14 states over there, former senior leader at HHS OIG, and we're aging Jason, but he is substantially older than all of us, 43 years, maybe not substantially, but 40, going on 45 years of healthcare fraud, waste, and abuse experience. And then Wade McFowell, former, I hate saying former because it implies that there was some nefarious conduct that led you to be something other than retired, but retired assistant special agent in charge from the Los Angeles field office with now probably going on 30 years of experience. And I'm the baby of the group with only about 27 years of experience out of the New York field office. So we want to spend the next half hour or so talking about a topic that is very important for people that are in fraud, waste, abuse, and compliance in one way or another, and that is the OIG work plan. You know, I told you guys the story about when I first met Advise's CEO, Jean Marie Loria. She came to me and she said, oh, I have this great question to ask you. I want to know, how often did you review the work plan? And I laughed and I said, you know, I think maybe I've looked at it twice in my whole career. And she couldn't believe it. And I had to explain to her that as an OIG agent in the Office of Investigations, we really didn't spend a lot of time on the work plan because we followed where the fraud went. And that the work plan is really an important tool and a really important administrative piece for other components of the OIG, such as the Office of Audit Services and the Office of Evaluation and Inspection. But it has some collateral effects on, for example, Matt and Jason, when you were at the UPICs, and Wade, he is helping to run one of our contracts with a large one of the blues around the country, and he is on the SIU team on a Medicaid side. And so you really see this kind of this piece kind of percolate out. Now, Matt talks about the work plan as a living document. So, Matt, I want to talk to you at first about that. And, you know, why is it that you see the work plan as a living document? And while you start to talk, I'm going to share my screen so we can really see what you're really talking about.
Sure. The work plan, I think, has been in existence since the start of the IGs in the IG Act. They were asked by Congress to submit these work plans annually. And in the beginning, that is what they did. It was a hard copy, once a year submission to Congress, similar to their twice a year submission of their semi-annual reports, which listed projects that they were planning, projects that they were in the middle of, or projects they had completed. And it was a stagnant document at that point. It was, you know, probably the beginning of the fiscal year in October, they would submit this to Congress. And that was their Bible for that year. And of course, during that year, lots of things change. You know, projects are dropped, projects are completed, other priorities come into play. But that document kind of stayed behind the times. Now, if you look at it, it's an online document. And it is hugely vast in terms of the projects that are being worked, the projects that are being planned, the ones that are completed. And it goes far beyond even, you know, CMS and Medicare and Medicaid, because HHS's umbrella goes beyond that. It talks about FDA projects, CDC, SAMHSA, the Administration for Children and Families. All of those things fall into this plan. And as those priorities change, new projects are added, as you can see as Eric showed you, new projects are planned. When projects are completed, they're marked as completed. If they're closed for any reason, they do that as well. So it is a living document that is really more, you know, up to the minute in terms of what the IG audits and evaluation inspections offices are working on or planning to work on. And it's a better reflection of their priorities.
Well, and I think it's important for everybody to understand that the OIG's role outside of the Office of Investigations, which does the criminal, civil, and administrative work, but OIGs in general are there to provide oversight about how the program is being conducted and how it's operationally working. And so oftentimes, I think the misunderstanding is that when Office of Audit Services does an audit on a hospital, for example, and they identify these overpayments, that it's unfortunate that the hospital becomes the victim of the overpayment analysis. But the point of the analysis is to identify whether or not CMS's policies are being implemented in the proper fashion. It's a little bit like when you see the Office of Evaluation and Inspection doing an empirical analysis upon whether or not an item, service, or procedure was being implemented properly. And I think that that's where there's a little bit of that divergence, is that as an agent at the OIG, we followed the fraud. It wasn't really with respect to whether or not Office of Audit Services was doing a study on X, Y, and Z, or OE&I was doing a study on X, Y, and Z. But Jason, I want to go to you now before I go to Wade. But one of the big things that always comes up in our conversations, and it came up on prior conversations we had with respect to UPIX, was this whole understanding of the work share and priorities and shifting priorities and how that actually percolates down to the UPIX. So maybe talk a little bit about, when the work plan comes out and it gets updated, which it does frequently, and particularly with COVID, and the fact that there was this huge shift in the work plan towards COVID-related things, when you were directing the Western UPIC, how did the work plan create either a tectonic shift in how you were going to, lead the organization? But then more importantly, how do you make the determination how you're going to fight the fires when there's one firefighter and four fires going on?
Well, that is the point, is that, how do you focus the limited resources that an entity has? And the work plan is the document that supports those priorities and initiatives. So in the pandemic, as you mentioned, had a large impact on what we could do. First off, there were some administrative prohibitions on the UPIX being able to secure information and documents from providers during that time. So, there had to be a shift in how the UPIX would still accomplish its mission. And then the other thing was that, since providers were now relying on telemedicine much, much more, telemedicine became a huge vulnerability. And so it created, frankly, an opportunity for growth to start to think about, well, how do you fight that fire, as you referenced, and what tools do you use to do that? So, in time, as much as the pandemic influenced how we receive our groceries and our medical treatment and anything else, it also allowed the UPIX then to figure out how they're going to meet those missions.
And so Wade, I want to go to you now, because so you wore two hats at the OIG. One is a working agent, and then supervising cases as a supervisor. And so first, was your opinion of the work plan the same as mine?
Well, as an agent, for sure, I didn't really have a need to look at it as an ASAC or a supervisor. I probably looked at it a little bit more, just because I don't disagree that, as agents and ASACs, we follow the fraud and it's always morphing into something new. So we have to be able to adapt to it. But there was also, like in budgeting, there was also these percentages where it was like 80, and these numbers are probably way off, but 86% of our time should be spent on Medicare cases, maybe 15%, or this won't equal 100, but another percent is on Medicaid. There's a certain percent on the 300 different programs that we're supposed to watch for different frauds, but the majority of it was Medicare. But I would look at it probably a little bit more often, just to see, okay, they want us to focus a little bit more on something other than just strict Medicare. It might be, even protection would get priority at some point around election time, so that type of thing. So I probably looked at it a little bit more than the typical agent, but I didn't. It wasn't my constitution that I, you know, based everything on by any means.
You know, and it's interesting that you say it in that context, because I remember, you know, a bunch of times when it would be towards the end of the fiscal year, it'd be the beginning of the summer, and you'd suddenly get an email where they would say, you know, management would say, all right, we're not meeting our percentage requirement on investigating grants. Everybody needs to work grant cases. And then, you know, along the way, you'd find out that there was an OIG work plan update where OIG was focusing on Head Start, for example, as a grant program. And now all of a sudden you'd have to shift. The humor is that if you didn't have a grant case in your inventory, and one person in the office had a grant case, that became the most well-worked case in the entire office. You know, because you needed to kind of make that up. But so now, you know, so one of the things that you see that is very prevalent in the work plan as a result of the pandemic is because there's been so much money that's been put out there, and you've got all of these agencies now looking at things. You see quite often in the work plan, there are kind of these niche reviews going on. So there's one that's coming up on laboratory services and Medicare's payment of laboratory services, which interestingly enough, I think that the OIG has looked at laboratory services a million times. I'm exaggerating, but a huge number of times over the years, the genetic testing, blood labs, urine drug testing, all of that is now, you know, you see the COVID stuff is going to be, I think that's going to be in the work plan for years to come. But Wade, you're kind of in the trenches on a very specific client that Advise has in the Medicaid space. You're one of a team of investigators that we've got and subject matter experts that are providing, you know, support to a very large Medicaid contract. What are some of the cases that you're currently working on? And have you been hearing from the leadership of where you're providing that support about, you know, are these things kind of intertwined with some of the things in the work plan?
Well, there's probably been about five or six different types of cases that I've been involved with. And again, not having recently reviewed the work plan, but we looked at it a little bit before this call and this morning. And it is interesting that a lot of the stuff that we are working and in the SIU, it kind of mirrors some of the priorities for the work plan. So I noticed some of the things kind of popped out to me, like hospice and home health is something we're seeing a lot of. And I know from speaking to, you know, my colleagues with the OIG on the West Coast, that's a huge problem there is hospice, not only from, you know, the physician certifying patients who aren't appropriate for it, but they're living longer than they're supposed to for hospice, that they should be in a condition where they're not going to last that long. They're towards the end of life. And a lot of these patients are living much longer than is expected. So they're considered inappropriate for hospice. Another one that we're seeing a lot of, excuse me, is pediatric medical daycare and adult medical daycare, which are, you know, they've been around for a while with the Medicaid, in the Medicaid space. We never dealt with them with the OIG because Medicare did not pay for that. But a lot of the different SIUs, I think, are dealing with this, especially during COVID, because they really relaxed the regulations and they weren't required to do, frankly, they weren't required to do much at all to be able to bill for the daily per diem. And more so for there's medical daycare, which has a higher level of care. And then there's like a social daycare where, frankly, all they really had to do during COVID was make a telephone call and make sure that the member was okay, didn't have any new issues, they were taking their medicine, that type of thing. So they could make a phone call, you know, a 10-minute phone call, and then they were able to bill the per diem for that whole day. So that's another one we're seeing a lot of. There's quite a few cases related to psychiatry fraud, where it's basically timed, you know, 15-minute increments, and they're, you know, it's easy for them to kind of exaggerate, you know, 15 minutes becomes 20, 25 minutes or 30, But the problem with that is, and this is where a lot of our analytics comes in, is they do that, you know, patient by patient, and they don't realize that it adds up. And then you, all of a sudden, you are in the position where you have these impossible days where you're billing, you're seeing the patient literally for 15 minutes, but you're billing for 30, and you do that for 8 hours in the day, and all of a sudden you have more hours than you're realistically working. So that's another one we're seeing quite a bit. And I guess the last one that we're seeing, and it's not necessarily COVID related, but some of these screenings, they have codes that are related to alcohol screening or tobacco cessation, a couple of other different ones, but they're really meant to be like a yearly code to bill. And it's really nothing more than the physician having a conversation with them about, you know, quitting smoking basically, or drinking less. And it's, so they typically should be like once a year or maybe twice a year, but we're seeing a lot of them billing them like monthly. And if you're talking to someone about quitting smoking every month, that's great, but you can't bill that code monthly when it's meant to be a yearly code.
I think those codes are also very similar to the advanced care planning, that G code that we see on the HCPCS side, on the Medicare side. As long as you're documenting that you've reviewed it and updated and have a copy of the document, there's no limit. So, you know, I worked on a project recently where, the doc was doing advanced care planning like every other month. Like, how many times do you have to change your advanced directive or your will? I guess you're changing your will if, you know, you like your family this week, you don't like your family next week. I would say, you know, that's just life. But, you know, it is interesting. So, Jason, I want to turn this over to you as we get ready to wrap up. But, you know, Wade brought up a good point about some things he's like with hospice and home health. And I know that, you know, when you were running the Western UPIC, and, you know, even now, like, that's a really, really hot topic, and all of the, you know, sort of schemes that go on with that. Why do you think that hospice is really become one of the sort of new pinch points in fraud schemes, and then in the collateral investigations that result from it?
Well, it really relates to a number of things that you find folks have already raised today. So it's following the money. There are really great reimbursements for that type of service. The other interesting thing, though, is so does the work plan follow the vulnerability, or is it the reverse of that? Does the vulnerability follow the work plan? Obviously, you know, there is some thought leadership that goes into thinking about, well, where do we want to go? And so then the work plan, you know, starts to drive those resources. But most times, in my humble opinion, it's going to be the situation that's on the street. So whether it's a pandemic, whether it's a legislative initiative such as the Deficit Reduction Act of 2006, which had, as you said, a tectonic shift in the federal government taking a front seat and a front role in mitigating fraud in the Medicaid program. So any number of factors are influencing it. And in terms of hospice, you know, it's, again, following the numbers. So, and these numbers aren't going to be 100% accurate. They're just in my head. But let's say there are 4,500 hospice providers in the United States. And if you look at data, something about 2,500 of them are in California. And of those 2,500, most of those are in Southern California. So it really doesn't take some significant data analysis to realize that, well, we've really got to focus some resources on that. Then when you look at what it takes to do a hospice investigation, that is just huge. The medical review becomes very comprehensive, because when you look at, if you, of course, most records are going to be electronic nowadays, but if you had a paper hospice record, most likely you're talking about several banker's boxes filled with records to look at. So you have to get really smart about how you're going to tackle that. And one final thought I'll just offer, I wish I could claim this axiom, but I think it's relevant, is that a goal without a plan is just a wish. So the work plan allows you to achieve those goals. Because otherwise, you can, you know, again, thought leaders can sit around and think about where they want to bring an organization or focus resources. But if there isn't a plan to get there, you're kind of just flailing your arms.
So it's interesting that you're not taking credit for that axiom, because most of the things that you say are known as Eisengrinisms. And people who've worked with you for years will know that there's a book that can be written just on the Eisengrinisms. So Matt, I want to turn this over to you as we wrap up for the last few minutes. Jason brought up something, the 2006 Deficit Reduction Act. I think some people have probably heard of it, but don't know really what it is. Just as our closing piece on this, because it is going to be relevant to how the work plan relates back to Medicaid, can you just talk a little bit about what is it and how does it actually directly affect the work plan?
Sure. Before I do that, I just want to touch on a couple things with the work plan itself. You know, it lists a lot of projects. One thing that it also has in it that is of benefit to SIUs or the UPICs, it has toolkits where the OIG shows their methodologies on how to build a data project in a vulnerable area. I know in the UPIC Northeast, we use the OIG toolkit on opioids and how to really dive into the misuse of the abuse of opioids. There's one on there right now on identifying adverse events through medical records. They have a toolkit, so it's almost like a how-to, which is a very nice tool to have. The Deficit Reduction Act in 2006, it put lots of money and lots of emphasis on Medicaid fraud on the for the federal level. But prior to that, the states were relied on to do the oversight of Medicaid through the MFUCUs, through the Attorney General's offices, through the SIUs and the state plans, and the OIG and federal law enforcement just kind of had oversight capability. The OIG itself oversees the MFUCUs generally to make sure that they're following the compliance plans and things like that. The Deficit Reduction Act kind of put the emphasis back on the federal government to play a direct role in protecting Medicaid from fraud, waste, and abuse, and bringing the matching funds back to the federal programs. So as a direct result of that, you know, we see the new, you know, the plan now, the work plan now has many, many Medicaid items in it on how to protect the program, on specific areas of vulnerability, on specific projects that need to be looked at, especially with managed care, where the vast majority of Medicaid funds are. And it's putting the onus on the UPICs and the OIG to do direct work there and bring the matching funds, the federal share, back to the federal government, working with the states. Where before, again, as an OIG agent, the only time I would deal with Medicaid would be perhaps if there were some funds there that could get the overpayment up, and then I'd, you know, try to enlist with the MFUCU to get a joint investigation going. But other than that, it was very rare that we had a Medicaid-only investigation.
Right. So that the Deficit Reduction Act of 2006 really did bring in the importance of Medicaid oversight to the federal government, which hadn't existed previously. And so as a result of that, there's this increase in work plan things that affect Medicaid payment that had previously not been there. So that's great. And that I think is something that people may not have realized, because you see Medicaid on the work plan, but people always wonder, like, why is the OIG looking at Medicaid? And the reality is that Medicaid is in many cases a 50% US government cost. So, you know, we have to have the oversight for it. So great talk as always. We're out of time. These times go quick. I think when we're just talking and brainstorming and learning things as we go along from each other's experiences, the time tends to go very quickly. So as always, I want to thank everybody for spending the time to tune in and listen to us four old salts talk about the good old days, the current days, and the future days. I think that when you start to look at some of these things that we talk about, you see it's just a recycling of things. It really is the same clown, same circus, different clowns. The press releases that come out to me and the work plan to me are sometimes the roadmap for how to do the fraud. I think it's important to be able to publish these things, but it's also at the same time a little bit of a double-edged sword on the information. So as always, it's great seeing you guys. For those of you that are going to be at NHCAA, It's going to be here in Orlando, where Advise is headquartered. If you are going to be in the Orlando area for the NHCAA, please come and see us. We will all be there. And we will all be available to meet with you, talk to you, shoot the breeze. It'll be great to be back in person at a meeting. We will be at our diner booth, which will be at the diner that is actually in the convention center area. And we've chosen to take that route because a lot of us are New Yorkers, and the best business that's done is always done over a cup of coffee in a diner. And so come see us, have a cup, have a little something to eat, or as we like to say in New York, come by, have a nosh. And hopefully we'll see you. And we'll see you at the next OIG Roundtable. Have a great day, everybody.
Thank you all.
Thank you.